Well, it's great to be here, and I love talking about C.S. Lewis, and it's hard to improve on Lewis himself, so I always feel a little inadequate just trying to summarize. So I'm going to be reading some good chunks so that you get some things, but I understand a number of you have been reading it too. So how many have read The Great Divorce? Great. So a lot of you have. So we're going to do some thinking about it, about the central theme that I've kind of put into the title here. You know, I've called it 10 Reasons for Refusing Heaven. As I've been working through it, a disclaimer here, I think there will only be 9 reasons tonight because of time. It can go on and on a bit, so I need to keep it within some limits there. But this idea of refusing heaven, and it's kind of a central theme that we'll get at here. In the preface to the book, there are a couple of important things that Lewis has to say about this book. And first of all, he just talks about what is The Great Divorce, a very kind of unique title. Somebody would see this and wonder what in the world is this about. But the divorce, of course, is the divorce between heaven and hell, or even more ultimately, the divorce between good and evil. And Lewis tells us that it was actually the title of a book by William Blake, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, that suggested this to him, not the content of that book. He says, I'm not sure I know what he's trying to say, if he read that. But it's just the concept of that. And he says, the attempt to make that marriage is perennial. And what he means by that, of course, is that there is this, especially in modern culture, this great dislike of distinctions, a desire to be tolerant, a desire to accept all beliefs and opinions. Intolerance is the great vice of modern times. And claiming certainty is considered to be arrogant by so many. So Lewis writes in the preface that he is addressing a disastrous error. And he describes it as the belief that reality never presents us with an absolutely unavoidable either-or. There's no need to reject anything as finally evil. Evil can develop into good. There's no such thing, actually, as real evil. And this is the disastrous error that he's trying to address here, that there's a divorce between good and evil, a distinction that needs to be made. He elaborates a little bit here in the preface where he says, the attempt to make the marriage is based on the belief that reality never presents us with an absolutely unavoidable either-or, that granted skill and patience and time enough, some way of embracing both alternatives can always be found, that mere development or adjustment or refinement will somehow turn evil into good without our being called on for a final and total rejection of anything we should like to retain. And that's the disastrous error that he is addressing. So the great divorce follows from making an absolute distinction between good and evil, believing that all roads don't really lead to the same place. Or in the image that he uses in the preface, you can't take all luggage with you on all journeys. On one journey, even your right hand or your right eye may be among the things you have to leave behind, he says. There's one sentence in this preface that kind of encapsulates the thesis of the book. And it's this sentence here. If we insist on keeping hell or even earth, we shall not see heaven. If we accept heaven, we shall not be able to retain even the smallest and most intimate souvenirs of hell. So what he's telling us is that reality presents us with choices such that if we choose one, we cannot have the other. And heaven and hell are, of course, the ultimate example of this. The other thing he wants to make clear in the preface before getting into the story itself is that this book is a fantasy. And in fact, he calls it on the title page a dream. And it's not meant to be a description of what heaven and hell are actually like as places. It's not factual about that. A fantasy, especially as Lewis describes it, is a story which uses images and pictures to convey abstract truths. It's what Lewis says is truth, but not fact. Truth, but not fact. And the story here really centers on people and certain kinds of people, a series of fictional characters who are given the opportunity to move from hell to heaven. And Lewis attempts to use images to convey something about the kind of people who choose hell over heaven, since he maintains that no one is in hell who doesn't want to be there. He's not trying to put forth a doctrine that souls in hell have a second chance. It's as though he's saying, let's just suppose that another chance to choose heaven is given to people who are in hell. And we'll see how it makes absolutely no difference for the people like these people that he presents to us. What Lewis is doing is very much like what Dante was doing. This is Lewis's Divine Comedy, you could say. Lewis, like Dante, goes on an imaginary journey from hell to heaven. And like Dante, he has a guide for part of the journey, George MacDonald, the 19th century writer who had such a profound influence on Lewis. And like Dante, he uses imagery to say something about some of the characteristics of the place that are not meant to be taken literally. So just as Dante has this downward spiral and all these amazing pictures that he gives us, and then finally Satan locked in ice at the very bottom center of the earth, where his beating wings actually keep the ice frozen that encapsulate him, fixed in that position. Lewis is doing the same thing, giving us images that say something about characteristics. So, how is hell pictured in this fantasy? The story actually begins in hell with Lewis standing in line at a bus stop that's supposedly in the center of a town in hell. And hell is a gray, dismal place where it's always raining and it's always dusk. And just for those of you that haven't read it, just to set the scene, let me just read part of the opening paragraph to get the picture, the description. I seemed to be standing in a busy queue by the side of a long, mean street. Evening was just closing in, and it was raining. I'd been wandering for hours in similar mean streets, always in the rain, and always in evening twilight. Time seemed to have paused on that dismal moment when only a few shops have lit up, and it is not yet dark enough for their windows to look cheering. And just as the evening never advanced to night, so my walking had never brought me to the better parts of the town. However far I went, I found only dingy lodging houses, small tobacconists, hoardings from which posters hung in rags, windowless warehouses, goods stations without trains, and bookshops of the sort that sell the works of Aristotle. I never met anyone. But for the little crowd at the bus stop, the whole town seemed to be empty. So just take one feature here. The semi-darkness of hell is an image of this inability to see clearly and the desire not to have to make distinctions, the dislike of distinctions and certainty. Everything's gray. There's no black and white. And it's a visual picture of this state of affairs. Later we learn that people here are able to provide houses for themselves by just imagining them. People inevitably quarrel with each other, with their neighbors, and then they don't want to live there anymore, so they move away and they just imagine another house farther away. And this explains why the area around the bus stop is empty, because this quarreling and moving repeats itself so often that people are eventually separated from each other by immense distances. Hell is an astronomically large place that's mostly empty, so that people don't have to deal with each other. Lewis, again, has invented a hell like this to highlight the characteristics of the people who are living there. The people in line for the bus immediately reveal themselves to be easily offended, disgruntled, bad-tempered, self-absorbed, lacking in self-control. They're incapable of being in close company with others. Half of them have quarreled and left before the bus ever comes because they can't stand to be with each other. Lewis's hell is an extension of these characteristics. People so self-absorbed that no real communion with others is possible, living in isolation at great distances from each other. People who insist on a reality of their own making rather than accepting reality as it is. They live in houses they build with their imaginations that don't keep out the rain. People who fear both light and darkness and live in perpetual dusk. Lewis has written a lot about hell in other books as well, and he describes in the preface to the Screwtape Letters the occupants of hell, and this is a very fitting description for the occupants of hell in this book as well. He says, "Everyone is perpetually concerned about his own dignity and advancement. Everyone has a grievance, and everyone lives the deadly serious passions of envy, self-importance, and resentment." These are the characteristics of these people that we'll meet here. In The Problem of Pain, he has a chapter on hell. And he says there that the lost souls in hell are characterized by their rejection of everything that is not simply themselves. Their rejection of everything that is not simply themselves. Later in The Great Divorce, Lewis asks MacDonald if heaven and hell are just states of mind. MacDonald answers very forcefully that it's blasphemy to suggest that heaven is a state of mind. It is reality itself, he says. But there's a sense in which hell is a state of mind. And he says it this way. "Hell is a state of mind." You never said a truer word. Sorry, I don't have a Scottish accent. "And every state of mind left to itself, every shutting up of the creature within the dungeon of its own mind, is in the end hell." This is the state of those that we meet. They are shut up in the dungeon of their own mind. It's quite an image. So the bus comes, and those left in line board the bus and travel to the outskirts of heaven. And at this point, we get one more really powerful image for the condition of the passengers as they draw near to their destination. Let me just read you this description as it gets brighter, and Lewis, it's lighter as they're getting closer and closer to the outskirts of heaven. And Lewis says, "I glanced round the bus. Though the windows were closed and soon muffed, the bus was full of light. It was cruel light. I shrank from the faces and forms by which I was surrounded. They were all fixed faces, full not of possibilities, but impossibilities. Some gaunt, some bloated, some glaring with idiotic ferocity, some drowned beyond recovery in dreams, but all in one way or another, distorted and faded. One had a feeling that they might fall to pieces at any moment if the light grew much stronger. That's an amazing image, I think, an amazing image. They're fixed faces, full not of possibilities, but impossibilities. This is a characteristic that Lewis says all fantasy has, is that the characters wear their insides on the outside. And on the outside, these fixed faces speak of the state of their hearts and their minds. They're hardened, they're fixed, they're stuck in a reality of their own making, incapable of seeing what is, incapable of change. MacDonald says later, there is always something they insist on keeping, even at the price of misery. There is always something they prefer to joy, that is, to reality. Now, in contrast to hell, Lewis's heaven is also gives us some imagery that's pretty remarkable. Heaven is bright and colorful and solid and immense and full of life. The passengers, as they get off the bus, suddenly appear as insubstantial by contrast. And Lewis says they're ghosts, man-shaped stains on the brightness of that air. It's quite an image. They are just on the outskirts of heaven, but Lewis takes in what he's seeing. This wide expanse of grassy country, tall trees and sky, which are brighter than anything he's ever seen before. The largeness of it, the expanse of it, makes him feel, interestingly, both free and exposed. And we get this interesting theme of exposure in heaven, because it's so bright and it's so open and big and everybody's trying to hide. And it goes right back to Genesis 3, where man's instinct is to cover himself, is to hide, is to find some place not to be exposed and to be seen for who he really is. And so Lewis feels this exposure when he's in this place. But because here they're literally, biblically, in the light, and there's no place to hide. The solidity of heaven is one of my favorite characteristics here. It's revealed when the passengers get off the bus and begin trying to walk. The grass is so solid and so hard that it doesn't bend under their feet, that it actually hurts their feet to walk on the grass. It stabs their feet. It's painful to walk. Lewis bends over to try to pick a daisy that he sees growing. He can't tug the stem. He can't break the stem, and he pulls the skin off his fingers trying to pick a daisy. He sees a little leaf that's fallen off a tree. He can't lift it. It's too heavy. There's something that solid and substantial about this place. The hugeness of it requires a readjustment of his mind and his vision. And just to get a little description in here, when he's walked a ways, and you see that also lots of time passes here, and he walks for quite a while, but he says, an immense yet lovely noise vibrated through the forest. Hours later, I rounded a bend and saw the explanation. Before me, green slopes made a wide amphitheater, enclosing a frothy and pulsating lake into which over many colored rocks a waterfall was pouring. Here, once again, I realized that something had happened to my senses, so that they were now receiving impressions which would normally exceed their capacity. On Earth, such a waterfall could not have been perceived at all as a whole. It was too big. Its sound would have been a terror in the woods for 20 miles. Here, after the first shock, my sensibility took both, as a well-built ship takes a huge wave. I exulted. The noise, though gigantic, was like giants' laughter, like the revelry of a whole college of giants together, laughing, dancing, singing, roaring at their high works. There's just this sense of hugeness. So what's this imagery telling us about heaven? I think one thing that's really central to this is this idea that MacDonald gives him, that heaven is reality itself. It is solid. It's substantial. It's full of light and color that's more intense than anything that's ever been seen. And later, Lewis learns that hell is almost nothing in comparison to the size of heaven, even though in hell, when he was there, there was this supposedly astronomical distance between everybody. But really, toward the end of the book, Lewis bends over and pulls up a blade of grass and says, "That's where the bus came through. That all hell fits beneath a blade of grass in heaven." That's the comparison we're given. These images turn upside down our idea of what is real and solid. We see solid reality as material reality. This is real. You know, I can touch it, I can feel it, I can sense it. This is solid reality. And we often, unfortunately, picture heaven as something sort of vague and indefinite and spiritual, as Mrs. Schaefer used to say, airy fairy, hard to get any idea of. Lewis is giving us an image that actually fits the scripture passages about those things which are called permanent, lasting, and unshakable. In Paul's words, the eternal weight of glory. Literally, it's what Lewis has given us in this solid, solid place. So now we're going to look at some of these people who have taken the bus and are being offered heaven. And we want to look particularly at what they can't let go of. What's the luggage that they can't leave behind? What's fixed about them? The first guy we'll look at is a guy named Ikey. Lewis had met him on the bus. He calls him the intelligent man in the bowler hat. He talks very knowingly about things. He's a materialist, though, in both senses of the word, a materialist. He believed that the real problem in hell wasn't the quarrelsomeness of people, but the fact that people had no needs to bring them together. He sees reality through economic lenses, and he says, there's no proper economic basis for any community life. There's got to be scarcity and demand for community to exist. It's a pretty sad view of community, isn't it? You need real shops and real houses and real goods. And he talks about this in this way. If they needed real shops, chaps would have to stay near where the real shops were. If they needed real houses, they'd have to stay near where builders were. It's scarcity that enables a society to exist. Well, that's where I come in. I'm not going on this trip for my health. As far as that goes, I don't think it would suit me up there. But if I can come back with real commodities, anything at all that you could really bite or drink or sit on, why, at once you'd get a demand down in our town. So that's his thing. He's got this plan to go to heaven and bring back real commodities that people can touch and taste. And this will create and lead to centralization, he says. People will start living together and not spreading out. Now, once they get there, just a little bit after, Lewis has walked off from the area where the people are gathered, he comes upon Ikey pretty close to the base of this waterfall and on the edge of this lake, and there's this gigantic tree full of golden apples. And Ikey says, "Ah, this is it. I'm going to take back these golden apples. That'll be my commodity. That'll be what I'll offer to people to create demand back here." And he's having a horrible time trying to figure out how to get the apples. And then this gust of wind blows some of them down, and some of them hit him, and practically knock him out, and bruise him, and hurt him, and injure them, because they're so solid. But he's determined. He wants to fill his pockets with these golden apples, but he can't even lift them up. They're so heavy, but he keeps trying, and he keeps trying. And there's this just amazing, amazing description. I could hardly help admiring this unhappy creature when I saw him rise staggering to his feet, actually holding the smallest of the apples in his hands. He was lame from his hurts, and the weight bent him double. Yet even so, inch by inch, still availing himself of every scrap of cover, he set out on his Via Dolorosa to the bus, carrying his torture. What a line. Carrying his torture. We see a picture of just extreme greed. He must have this thing, even though it's torturing him to carry it. And the message is so clear that God's gifts become burdens when we focus on them and make them, not him, the object of our desires. They become burdens like this. He hears the voice of an angel that's in the waterfall, offering him the apples and more if he'll just stay and learn to eat such apples. But he can't see, and he can't hear, and he can't change. Eyes that cannot hear and eyes that cannot see come to mind. The real things he wants are here for the taking in spades. More reality than he can take. But he sought them for the wrong reason. To use for his own purposes, to provide security for himself. He can't take them on their own terms. So, he goes back. What's he holding on to? He's holding on to trust in his ability to provide for himself with real commodities. His rejection of heaven is a refusal to trust in another, to believe that all things could be his in Christ, that all needs are met in Christ. He's got to provide for himself. Now, before going on to the next ghost, we need to see a little bit about talk a little bit about the inhabitants of heaven, because someone from heaven who knew each of these ghosts on earth has actually been sent to meet him or her there. And we get some descriptions of them that we'll see as we go along. But these people are solid and bright. Their feet sink into the grass. Some are robed, some are naked. And Lewis comments, "The naked ones did not seem less adorned, and the robes did not disguise in those who wore them the massive grandeur of muscle and radiant smoothness of flesh." We learn then about the other ghosts that we're going to see, basically from the conversations that these bright ones, these solid ones, have with the ones that they've come to meet, and Lewis overhears these conversations. So the next ghost is called the Big Ghost. He was an employer, a big boss, a rough fellow, and I think we'll come to see him as a legalist. He's met by a man named Len, who was one of his employees, and we learn that Len actually killed a man in a fit of anger. And when the big ghost sees Len, he just can't get beyond the fact that here's this guy who murdered somebody in heaven, and was in hell. He is terribly offended. "It ain't right," he says, "this murderer in heaven." His sense of justice is violated. We learn that he thinks people should get what they deserve, and that they should earn whatever they get. He's out for his rights. He should get what is his by rights. "I done my best all my life, see," he says. There is absolutely no place in his view for forgiveness and grace. He says, "I only want my rights. I'm not asking for anyone's bleeding charity." To which Len responds, "Oh, then do. At once. Ask for the bleeding charity. Everything is here for the asking. and nothing can be bought. Len goes on then to point out to this employer, former employer of his, that he actually hadn't done his best a lot of the time, that many people had been hurt and suffered because of his harsh, cruel ways, both within his family and within the business where he worked. And then Len confesses to him and reveals to him that the reason that he's come to meet him is because he wants to ask forgiveness for murdering him in his heart over years and years and years that he was working for him. This is a sin he considers as worse than his murder of Jack in a fit of rage. Jack being in heaven with Len, and they're fine. but the big ghost is just can't possibly take any of this in. He says, "You mind your own business, young man," said the ghost. "None of your lips, see? Because I'm not making any impudence. I'm not taking any impudence from you about my private affairs." "There are no private affairs," said the other. "And I'll tell you another thing. You can clear off, see? You're not wanted. I may be only a poor man, but I'm not making pals with a murderer, let alone taking lessons from him. Make it hard for you and your like, did I? If I had you back there, I'd show you what work is." "Come and show me now," said the other with laughter in his voice. "It will be joy going to the mountains, but there will be plenty of work." "You don't suppose I'd go with you?" "Don't refuse. You will never get there alone, and I am the one who was sent to you." "Ah, so that's the trick, is it?" shouted the ghost, outwardly bitter. And yet I thought there was a sense of triumph in its voice. It had been entreated. It could make a refusal, and this seemed to it a kind of advantage. "I thought there'd be some damn nonsense. It's all a click, all a bloody click. Tell him I'm not coming, see? I'd rather be damned than go along with you. I came here to get my rights, see? Not to go sniveling along on charity tied onto your apron strings." He can't let go of the view that he's been wronged. He rejects heaven in the name of justice. And because of his desire to earn his own way. So his is a refusal of grace. He can't accept his need for grace. Now, the next one I could have spent a whole lecture on. It's a minister. The cultured ghost. We find that this minister is a bit of a modernist and a relativist and has a kind of odd definition of spirituality. He believes in a spirituality which is above questions of truth and falsehood. Fortunately, this is not actually an unusual view in our day. But Lewis first encounters him on the bus, and he, this minister, attempts to interrupt the discussion when they're all talking about their fear of it getting dark in hell. He gives them this calm, reasoned reinterpretation, his interpretation of the grayness of hell. And it gives you a very good idea of his kind of thinking. "There's not a shred of evidence that this twilight is ever going to turn into night. There's been a revolution of opinion on that in educated circles. I'm surprised that you haven't heard of it. All the nightmare fantasies of our ancestors are being swept away. What we now see in this subdued and delicate half-light is the promise of the dawn, the slow turning of a whole nation towards the light, slow and imperceptible, of course. And that passion for real commodities, which our friend speaks of, is only materialism, you know. It's retrogressive, earthbound, a hankering for matter. But we look on this spiritual city with all its faults. For with all its faults, it is spiritual, as a nursery in which the creative functions of man, now freed from the clogs of matter, begin to try their wings, a sublime thought." So for him, hell is a spiritual city. and the grayness is the promise of dawn. What does he mean by spiritual? For him, it seems to mean unsubstantial, indefinite. It's not a very clear idea. Now, he's met in heaven by a man that he went to school with. It was a fellow theology student, and they both went into the ministry. And then there's this interchange between them early on in what is a rather long discussion between them. It is quite telling. So the ghost says, "Ah, Dick, I shall never forget some of our talks. I expect you've changed your views a bit since then. You became rather narrow-minded towards the end of your life, but no doubt you've broadened out again." "How do you mean?" "Well, it's obvious by now, isn't it, that you weren't quite right. Why, my dear boy, you were coming to believe in a literal heaven and hell." "But wasn't I right?" "Oh, in a spiritual sense, to be sure. I still believe them in a way. I'm still, my dear boy, looking for the kingdom, but nothing superstitious or mythological." "Excuse me? Where do you imagine you've been?" "Ah, I see. You mean that gray town with its continual hope of mourning? We must all live by hope, must we not? With its field of indefinite progress is in a sense heaven, if only we have eyes to see it. That is a beautiful idea." "I didn't mean that at all. Is it possible you don't know where you've been? Now that you mention it, I don't think we ever do give it a name. What do you call it?" "We call it hell." "There's no need to be profane, my dear boy. I may not be very orthodox in your sense of the word, but I do feel that these matters ought to be discussed simply and seriously and reverently." "Discuss hell reverently?" "I meant what I said. You have been in hell." So you see the kind of impasse that these two are in. Again, we see that for him, spiritual just means something vague and subjective, basically. He can't see the truth of where he's been, and he calls it, in a sense, heaven. They have a long conversation, and we learn several things that he can't accept. He can't accept that there are absolute fixed truths. He calls this stagnation and declares that there is no such thing as a final answer. He can't accept that one would be punished for honestly held opinions. These honest opinions turn out to be basically what makes sense to him, to his critical faculties, as he calls it. Being true to himself matters more than the truth. And he can't see how influenced he was by current ideas and the desire to fit in with the modern and successful people of his age. Dick says to him, "Oh, as you love your own soul, remember, we didn't want the other to be true. We were afraid of crude salvationism, afraid of a breach with the spirit of the age, afraid of ridicule, afraid above all of real spiritual hopes and fears." Dick begs him to go with him further in and up to the mountains to see reality clearly as it is. He refuses to go without an assurance that he won't have to change his views. He says he must be allowed the free play of the mind, the free spirit of inquiry. And he won't accept the idea that Dick tries to get in, that inquiry is just a means, that inquiry was made for truth. But that is not a welcome idea to him. And so he says, "The suggestion that I should return at my age to the mere factual inquisitiveness of boyhood strikes me as preposterous. In any case, that question and answer conception of thought only applies to matters of fact. Religious and speculative questions are surely on a different level." "We know nothing of religion here. We think only of Christ. We know nothing of speculation. Come and see. I will bring you to eternal fact, the father of all facthood." I should object very strongly to describing God as a fact. The supreme value would surely be a less inadequate description. It is hardly... Do you not even believe that he exists? Exists? What does existence mean? You will keep on implying some sort of static, ready-made reality, which is, so to speak, there, and to which our minds have simply to conform. And you hear Lewis in The Abolition of Man. These great mysteries cannot be approached in that way. If there were such a thing, there is no need to interrupt, my dear boy. Quite frankly, I should not be interested in it. It would be of no religious significance. God, for me, is something purely spiritual. The spirit of sweetness and light and tolerance and service, Dick. Service. We mustn't forget that, you know. Finally, he says he must go back because he has a talk to give at the Theological Society, and he must do his duty for others. He's fixed in his view that there are no absolutes, that truth is relative. He cannot let go of the free play of the mind. His rejection of heaven is a refusal of certainty. The next one is the skeptic, the hard-bitten ghost, as Lewis calls him, who's a skeptic. He's suspicious of everyone. He sees through everything. Nothing is what it seems. He's determined not to be taken in. He blames everything, because nothing's right about anything for him. He blames everything on them, on people he calls the management. He says, I'm the sort of chap who likes to see things for himself. Wherever I've been, I've always had a look at anything that was being cracked up. When I was out east, I went to see Peking. What was Peking like? Nothing to it. Just one darn wall inside another. Just a trap for tourists. I've been pretty well everywhere. Niagara Falls, the pyramids, Salt Lake City, Taj Mahal. What was it like? Not worth looking at. They're all advertisement stunts, all run by the same people. There's a combine, you know, a world combine. Just takes an atlas and decides where they're going to make a site. Doesn't matter what they choose. Anything will do as long as the publicity's properly managed. So, he sees the offer of heaven very much in the same light as the same old trick. They've got you either way. You can't live here. You can't drink the water. You can't eat stuff that you can hardly pick up. He says heaven and hell are actually run by the same people. It's a conspiracy. They just pretend to be at war. There's nothing worth doing in either place, according to him. When Lewis asks him what he'd like to do if he had a choice, he says, don't ask me. It's their responsibility to come up with something interesting for us to do. He shifts the responsibility for something that isn't boring onto the management. So his view allows him to complain, to not take responsibility for anything. He basically believes that nothing can be changed. And he holds on to the fact that he can't be taken in or made a fool of. His fear of being taken in keeps him from seeing anything for what it really is. He's a skeptic completely consumed by his view that nothing is what it seems, that all people have ulterior motives and are out to take advantage of others. He's very much like the dwarfs at the end of the last battle. Who can't see the banquet laid out for them in the stable, if you've read that Narnia story. And what Aslan says about these dwarfs is very true about this ghost. This is the quote from the last battle. They have chosen cunning instead of belief. Their prison is in their own minds. Yet they are in that prison and so afraid of being taken in that they cannot be taken out. Lewis sees skepticism as an abdication of responsibility to seek understanding, to seek the truth. This ghost's rejection of heaven is a refusal of belief. He holds on to his determination not to be tricked. Next, Lewis has a short encounter with a well-dressed female ghost. Her identity is all wrapped up in her appearance. She's trying to find some place to hide, and she tells the Bright One who's been sent to meet her that she can't be seen like this. I'd have never come if I'd known you were all going to be dressed like that. The irony, of course, being that some of them are not dressed at all. And yet they're clothed in a glory, the glory of true humanity. Their brightness and solidity show up the female ghosts' shadows of finery. It's who they are, not their dress, that undoes her. She says, "But they'll see me." She can't face the idea of being uncovered, exposed. She's avoided the shame of being seen for who she is by convincing herself that outward appearance is everything. She is her appearance. But the Bright One cuts right to the heart of the matter and says to her, "Shame is like that. If you will accept it, if you will drink the cup to the bottom, you will find it very nourishing. But try to do anything else with it, and it scalds." In other words, she must walk in the light. She must tell the truth about who she is as a person in her need and allow herself to be seen in her neediness. Shame covered over, pretending we have nothing to be ashamed of, destroys us. The scalding that he talks about. This ghost almost yields, then says, "I can't. It's disgusting to ask me to do a thing like that." Her mind is fixed on herself. So the bright spirit responds and says, "Friend, could you only for a moment fix your mind on something not yourself?" "I've already given you my answer," said the ghost, coldly but tearfully. "Then only one expedient remains," said the spirit. And to my great surprise, he set a horn to his lips and blew. I put my hands over my ears. The earth seemed to shake. The whole wood trembled and dindled at the sound. I heard the thudding of hooves, far off at first, but already nearer before I had well identified it, and soon so near that I began to look about for some place of safety. Before I had found one, the danger was all about us. A herd of unicorns came thundering through the glades, 27 hands high, the smallest of them, and white as swans, but for the red gleam in the eyes and nostrils and flashing indigo of their horns. I heard the ghost scream, and I think it made a bolt away from the bushes, perhaps toward the spirit. But I don't know, for my own nerve failed. The one expedient left was fear. Fear. This was an attempt to frighten her out of herself, out of hiding. Heaven, that is Christ, wants us even if we come out of fear. She might have run for the bus, but she might have run toward the mountains. We don't know, really, because Lewis doesn't stay. If she ran toward the bus, hers was a refusal of glory, the glory which comes through self-knowledge and repentance. Next character is one of my favorites, the artist. I have several members of my parents' lit class on this book who heard this morning. Sorry. This artist, famous on earth, is met by another artist who is a friend of his who's in heaven. And the conversation that they have together shows that this ghost artist has lost his understanding of why he painted. Painting has become an end in itself rather than a means to an end. He keeps asking, "When can I start painting? When can I paint here in heaven?" And when he's told looking comes first, he becomes impatient. He wants to paint. His desire to paint is getting in the way of him really seeing, just looking, just seeing what's there. And the Solid One, who's come to meet him, reminds him of something that he's forgotten from when he first started as a painter. When you painted on earth, at least in your earlier days, it was because you caught glimpses of heaven in the earthly landscape. The success of your painting was that it enabled others to see the glimpses too. But here, you are having the thing itself. It is from here that the messages came. There is no good telling us about this country, for we see it already. In fact, we see it better than you do. There's no reason for him to paint here until he can see, and perhaps see, what others can't see. And then, maybe, he can paint again. Art should be done for the love of the thing seen. His first love shouldn't be paint, but light. And this is how his friend talks about this. If you are interested in the country only for the sake of painting it, you'll never learn to see the country. But that's just how a real artist is interested in the country. No, you're forgetting. That was not how you began. Light itself was your first love. You loved paint only as a means of telling about light. Oh, that was ages ago, said the ghost. One grows out of that. Of course, you haven't seen my later works. One becomes more and more interested in paint for its own sake. One does indeed. I also have to recover from that. It was all a snare. Ink and catgut and paint were necessary down there, but they are also dangerous stimulants. Every poet and musician and artist, but for grace, is drawn away from the love of the thing he tells to the love of the telling, till down in deep hell they cannot be interested in God at all, but in only in what they say about him. For it doesn't stop at being interested in paint, you know. They sink lower, become interested in their own personalities, and then in nothing but their own reputations. The spirit tells him that in order to be cured of this, he must forget forever all proprietorship in your own works. The artist can't face that, and changes the subject and says, are there any distinguished artists? Can't we meet some distinguished artists who are here? And the spirit says, everybody here is distinguished. The glory flows into everyone and back from everyone, like light and mirrors. But the light's the thing. This artist can't let go of his concern for his reputation. He calls it his duty to the future of art. And when the spirit tells him that he's been forgotten on earth, he's horrified. He says, I've got to go back. I've got to write an article. I've got to publish a journal. I've got to revive people's interest in my art. And he is off to get back on the bus. He can't let go of his self-importance, his reputation as an artist. He rejects heaven, and he rejects light, vision. In confusing means with ends, and this is a theme that runs up like a thread through a lot of these, confusing means with ends. He's confused means with ends, and so he's lost the chance to see the one thing worth seeing, the face of God, the beatific vision. The next one is a very controlling and self-absorbed woman married to a man named Robert. Robert is in heaven. She's come on the bus. And she's met by her sister-in-law, and she immediately unleashes this fury that her husband is in heaven without her. And after the sister-in-law tries to ask a question or two, this woman launches into a monologue without allowing any interruption for the whole rest of the chapter. There is no conversation in this chapter. It's this running monologue by this angry, angry woman. This is an amazing device that Lewis has given us to reveal something about this woman. She is so self-absorbed that she's incapable of entertaining anyone else's views or ideas. Her own thoughts and feelings are all that matter to her. She can't take in anything else. And according to her, she has sacrificed her life to make something out of Robert and gotten nothing for it. And according to her, Robert is ungrateful, lazy, selfish, dull. But you read between the lines as she talks, and you see this poor man who was long-suffering, patient, interested in writing, but he couldn't get enough quiet to do it. And he worked long, long hours to please this wife who wanted to improve him. She wants him to have a better job, better friends, better house. She cares absolutely nothing for him or for his interests. What she actually did for him was make his life miserable. She drove off his old friends. She gave him no peace or encouragement so that he could write. And eventually she drove him to depression and a nervous breakdown. She tells her sister-in-law that she'll stay and meet Robert only if she's allowed to take charge of him again. I must have someone to do things to. Not for, to, she says. When she's refused, she is literally consumed by her intense anger and hatred of all that isn't herself and under her control. I want Robert. What right have you to keep me from him? I hate you. How can I pay him out if you won't let me have him? The ghost, which had towered up like a dying candle flame, snapped suddenly. A sour, dry smell lingered in the air for a moment, and then there was no ghost to be seen. No humanness left in her, and so she disappeared, consumed by hate. She rejects anything other, anything she can't control, anything outside of herself, and so refuses heaven. Next, Lewis witnesses a conversation between a mother and her brother. This mother is angry at God for taking away her son, Michael, and she wants desperately, he's there in heaven, she wants desperately to see him. Her brother tells her she must learn to want someone else besides her son before she can see him. And says, you will become solid enough for Michael to perceive you when you learn to want someone else besides Michael. It's only the little germ of a desire for God that we need to start the process. Oh, you mean religion and all that sort of thing? This is hardly the moment. And from you, of all people. Well, never mind. I'll do what's necessary. What do you want me to do? Come on. The sooner I begin it, the sooner you'll let me see my boy. I'm quite ready. But, Pam, do think. Don't you see you are not beginning at all as long as you are in that state of mind? You're treating God only as a means to Michael. But the whole thickening treatment consists in learning to want God for his own sake. She's told that there's no such thing as being only a mother. And she's made a false religion of mother love by making it the highest thing. And she is very offended at this idea. You cannot love a fellow creature fully till you love God. This is all nonsense, cruel and wicked nonsense. What right have you to say things like that about mother love? It is the highest and holiest feeling in human nature. Pam, Pam, no natural feelings are high or low, holy or unholy in themselves. They are all holy when God's hand is on the rein. They all go bad when they set up on their own and make themselves into false gods. It's through our love for God that all other loves become what they should be. Quote, there is one good, that is God. Everything else is good when it looks to him, and bad when it turns from him. She actually loved her son too little, not too much. She demands to see him. No one had a right to come between me and my son, not even God. I want my boy, and I mean to have him. He is mine. She loves him as an extension of herself. She never asks anything about him in this whole conversation. She's wrapped up in her own pain and her own loss. Hers is a very sad rejection of real love in the name of false love or idolatry. Next, Lewis gives us a closer look of one of the bright ones, and this leads into the last ghost that we're going to look at here. But this is one of my favorite passages here, because we have this amazing look more closely at redeemed humanity. There's a kind of procession, and he says, some kind of procession was approaching us, and the light came from the persons who composed it. First came bright spirits, not the spirits of men, who danced and scattered flowers. Then, on the left and right, at each of the forest, at each side of the forest avenue, came youthful shapes, boys upon one hand and girls upon the other. If I could remember their singing and write down the notes, no man who read that score would ever grow sick or old. Between them were musicians, and after that, a lady, in whose honor all this was being done. I cannot now remember whether she was naked or clothed. If she were naked, then it must have been the almost visible penumbra of her courtesy and joy, which produces in my memory the illusion of a great and shining train that followed her across the happy grass. If she were clothed, then the illusion of nakedness is doubtless due to the clarity with which her innermost spirit shone through the clothes. For clothes in that country are not a disguise. The spiritual body lives along each thread and turns them into living organs. A robe or a crown is there as much one of the wearer's features as a lip or an eye. But I have forgotten, and only partly do I remember the unbearable beauty of her face. Is it? I whispered to my guide. Not at all, he said. It's someone you'll never have heard of. Her name on earth was Sarah Smith, and she lived at Golders Green. She seems to be, well, a person of particular importance. Aye, she is one of the great ones. You have heard that fame in this country and fame on earth are two quite different things. Lewis thinks that it must be the Virgin Mary. But it's Sarah Smith of Golders Green, a very ordinary woman, but not well known at all. But here, where greatness is defined differently, she is one of the great ones. And the reason for that is because of her loving, unselfish service to everyone she met. And she's come to meet a ghost, her husband Frank. And Frank appears as two ghosts. One of them's a dwarf, and the other's a tall actor, the tragedian, he's called. And they're linked together by a chain. And Sarah addresses the dwarf with great warmth and love. And we see that the dwarf is the real Frank. And he holds the chain, which is attached to a collar around the neck of the actor. She pays no attention to the actor. But as she talks to the dwarf, he grows a little bit bigger as she talks to him. She tries to convince him to drop the chain, but he won't. The actor... it's just that. The actor is the facade which Frank has adopted, the tragic, please pity me act that he's played all his life. And he's easily mistaken for the real person because of his size, but he's not the real Frank. She addresses the dwarf, but the actor does almost all the talking. He wants to know if she's missed him. He's convinced that she can't really be happy without him. Can't accept that she doesn't need him to be happy. She's offended that she's not miserable without him. And he's very dramatic and in expressing all of this. So and now, said the tragedian with a hackneyed gesture of despair, now you need me no more. But of course not, said the lady, and her smile made me wonder how both the phantoms could refrain from crying out with joy. What needs could I have, she said, now that I have all? I am full now, not empty. I'm in love himself, not lonely, strong, not weak. You shall be the same. Come and see. We shall have no need for one another now. We can begin to love truly. But the tragedian was still striking attitudes. She needs me no more. No more. No more. he said in a choking voice to no one in particular. Would to God, continued he, would to God I had seen her lying dead at my feet, lying dead at my feet, lying dead at my feet. I do not know how long the creature intended to go on repeating the phrase, for the lady put an end to that. Frank, Frank, she cried in a voice that made the whole wood ring. Look at me, look at me. What are you doing with that great, ugly doll? Let go of the chain. Send it away. It's you I want. Don't you see what nonsense it's talking? Merriment danced in her eyes. She was sharing a joke with the dwarf, right over the head of the tragedian. Something not at all unlike a smile struggled to appear on the dwarf's face, for he was looking at her now. Her laughter was past his first defenses. He was struggling hard to keep it out, but already with imperfect success. And in spite of her merriment and love, she cannot get the dwarf to drop the chain. Lewis says, I do not know that I ever saw anything more terrible than the struggle of the dwarf ghost against joy. He insists that he would lose his self-respect if he were to accept love and joy on her terms. And Lewis learns, as the conversation goes on, that the ghost's act is to use pity as a kind of blackmail. Those who choose misery can hold joy up to ransom by pity. He can't give up appealing for her pity, and eventually the dwarf disappears, and she explains that his attempt to drag her into his misery will not work here. Did you think joy was created to live always under that threat? Here is joy that cannot be shaken. Our light can swallow up your darkness, but your darkness cannot now infect our light. When all that's left is the actor, she tells him that she cannot love a lie. I cannot love the thing that is not. He has rejected joy, and this refusal results in his disappearance. Lewis is dealing here, and goes on quite a bit, and I'll just try to very briefly summarize it, with the question of how can anyone be happy in heaven knowing that friends or family are in hell. And he asks MacDonald, how is it that she could be untouched by his misery? And MacDonald answers that while it seems merciful that those in heaven should grieve for the lost in hell, that there's something wrong lurking behind that idea. Let me just read you one bit of that. What some people say on earth is that the final loss of one soul gives the lie to all the joy of those who are saved. Ye see, it does not. I feel in a way that it ought to. That sounds very merciful, but see what lurks behind it. What? The demand of the loveless and the self-imprisoned that they should be allowed to blackmail the universe, that till they consent to be happy on their own terms, no one else shall taste joy, that there should be the final power, that hell should be able to veto heaven. Earlier in this chapter, Lewis refers to the chain held by the dwarf not as a lifeline, but as a death line. This is a perfect image for each of these characters who have refused heaven. Each clutches a death line and refuses to let it go. They, of course, give other names to what they are holding on to, names such as justice, honesty, personal integrity, duty, self-respect, even love. But what they are actually doing is choosing against grace, choosing against trust, against love, against joy, by holding on to a reality of their own making. This key theme is summed up in this final quote by George MacDonald to Lewis. There are only two kinds of people in the end, those who say to God, thy will be done, and those to whom God says, thy will be done. All that are in hell choose it. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. And that's it. Now, there's so much more in this book. I'm glad that most of you are reading it, and I hope anybody who hasn't read it will read it, because Lewis is just amazing, the themes that he deals with here. But let's talk about whatever you'd like to talk about that comes out of this. Or you might want to share some of the things that you've come to see or learned or loved about it as you've been reading it. Yeah.
Linnea, oh, I was just wondering if there's any significance to the number of characters that he has.
I don't think so. I've skipped a lot of them. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot more that are here. I find it interesting. I think it's more just the types. There's an awful lot of them where there's a family relationship involved. And then there's this theme running through it of people who mistake, who make ends out of means, you know, mistaking ends and means. Real, it's a very interesting theme, and a real problem, I think.
Do you think there's some list that he's working from, or
I don't think so.
I mean, the way that Narnia has been attached to the
I don't see anything like that, and I don't think so. I think some of them come out of some of his. I sort of see little bits and pieces of some of his own experiences, and you know, maybe Mrs. Moore making his life difficult as a writer at later stages of her life. I don't know. I mean, I think that it's more just his. He's got this incredible understanding of human nature, and I think he's trying to kind of cover the gamut of these excuses that people come up with. You know, I've got to have my self-respect. Josh.
Linnea, thank you. I was curious if you could say, so I know this book is a dream.
Yes.
He calls it a dream, and it's not a theological treatise.
Yeah.
But I've heard people across the theological spectrum use Lewis sort of as their, to sort of back them up, their own views of eternal judgment or heaven or hell. Does he, in other places?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just curious, because I haven't read all of him. Does he sort of align himself with any camp? I've heard people call him, everything from the universalist to...
Hey, well, you should read the chapter where he and MacDonald talk about these things. That is so profound that I mean, that would take a whole lecture just in itself. They have a conversation about time and eternity and about, all these things and universalism. He's saying, MacDonald, I thought you were a universalist. And MacDonald is saying, well, that name only makes sense in time, but I can't even explain it, but it's just there's some really profound discussion there. But yes, his nonfiction, I mean, there's a lot in even Mere Christianity, The Problem of Pain, where he addresses some of these things. But he's not a universalist.
I think he
ascribes to some form of purgatory, but I think more in the light of just a purifying experience for people who are definitely on their way to heaven. Otherwise, I'm not sure if there are other areas
that
you're thinking. Yeah, Problem of Pain has some really good material in it on this.
So I see echoes of the way that he describes heaven in this book, very similar to The Last Battle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not even just The Last Battle, but several books in Narnia, idea of Narnia being, it's like a mountain in our world, but like a mountain you've never seen before,
yes,
right?
Yes.
It's this kind of more real, this idea of something that's more real.
Yeah, and even, right.
And that really... that's what I want.
It's
to
so
be
appealing.
Like, it's so appealing.
It's not static.
Right.
This idea of moving further in and further up, and that's in Narnia and that's here too.
Yeah.
It's not, perfection is not a static state. It seems so boring.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, the possibility that the artist could actually, if he would move in and look and observe and see, he might, there might be something he could paint that would help some of the ones that are still back there coming along,
right.
See something.
And
know?
That idea of the solidity of things.
Yeah,
are,
yeah, I love that.
I do too, and I want that. I'm just tempted to treat it as scripture because I love it so much, and it's not, but
yeah.
it's a great,
no, but well, the concept
but
is, so when,
yeah,
when it's, that talks about, you know, those scriptures that talk about you know, that this is unshakable. In Hebrews, the end of Hebrews 13, I think it's in 13, where he gets to talking about, you know, these things that cannot be shaken. Mm-hmm. And then in the contrast between the momentary light afflictions and the eternal weight of glory. Mm-hmm. This is temporary. This is lasting. This is permanent. And I think that's what he's getting at, those scriptures that say this is reality. This is permanent reality, the way it's redeemed. It's the heavens. It's a new heavens and a new earth. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's earth as it was meant to be, but the better. It's paradise. Yeah. Yeah, and it's there are things to learn, and there's things to do, and there's ways to grow in it. I think that's a that you can, you know, find ways to support that idea. It's very appealing. The other place is the sermon, The Weight of Glory,
mm-hmm.
Which is one of the most fabulous pictures of heaven. If you haven't read that sermon, it's really, really wonderful. Yeah. There's just I could have gone on and on, but it's hard to just give a little bit. Yes.
I was gonna say like that it occurred to me too, like even though that idea of heaven being so real and so tangible, like it's not, I guess, like I can't point to scripture that would support that, but I think the fact that it's so commonly held, like from a human perspective, that like, oh, it's just an illusion, and like so many people believe that. I would think that, like, you know, like if I were like Satan and I wanted people like not to like go to heaven, I want them to be like, it's just an illusion, like.
Exactly.
And so, if you know that that's like the opposite of the truth, then how much more real is heaven? And,
yeah.
I don't know. Like that occurred to me too.
Yeah.
Like, if you feel like it's, yeah, like I just think like it must be so much more real because he doesn't want people to believe that it is.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. It's a new creation. It's perfect. but perfection isn't static. That's the idea. Yeah.
Do you know much about the timing in which this was written and Tolkien writing Leif by Niggle and any of their sort of dialogues about heaven?
Not about that specific thing, I don't. That would be interesting. It hints that it was written during the war, because at the very end, when he wakes up from the dream, he hears sirens. so at least he's, or a little after the war maybe, because it's as though he were in England during World War II, and he's having this dream. But I would say when it was written. But no, I don't know when Leif by Niggle was written either. I'd have to look into that. Yeah, that would be interesting. I wouldn't be surprised that they had some talks about
sharing
that kind
ideas.
Of thing. Yeah. 46. 46, right after the war. That's funny. Wrote it. Yeah. Yeah, Ben.
I noticed one of the, because your lecture was about things that keep people from heaven, you didn't mention the one ghost that actually decides to stay.
Well, that's the one I left out, unfortunately.
Yeah. I was wondering if you wanted to say anything about it.
Well, and that was one of, you know, and that's the other thing, that there's just too much to do, but Lewis is, you know, wants to know, is this a trick, or can they stay?
Is it possible?
So there is the possibility that female with the thundering herd of unicorns ran toward the mountains. That was the hope, that she would. And that's when he gets his answer that, yeah, there is a chance. But then, it's in the same chapter as the mother love, and he said it's about lust. That guy, is that the one you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Lizard on his shoulders.
But, yeah. This lizard that stands for lust, and it has to be killed.
Yeah.
And he can't stand, but he wants it to be, but he doesn't want to know about it, he doesn't want to choose to do it, he wants it to just... But they say, no, you've got to choose to kill this. You've got to choose to have it killed.
Yeah.
And then when it's killed, it turns into a stallion. Yeah. And he jumps on the stallion and he races into heaven. And it's this whole idea of the rightness of the order of love and our passions, you know, under the control. Something so powerful, but under the control. Under control of this stallion that he's able to ride instead of this horrible little lizard on his shoulder that just tortures him all the time. Yeah, and he stayed.
Yeah. I was struck by how half-hearted his decision to stay is, but how just the tiny movement towards heaven is accepted somehow. I don't even remember the words.
Well, there are other little hints of the kind of people who stay are the ones who see their need.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who are able to see their need. And so we were just talking about this morning. It's the same thing that where Christ goes to the really needy people because they know they're needy. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's all these people who think they've got it all together and everything, and they're sort of impervious to the message. And you get the same thing there, that there are some who are horrible, these monsters who come to try to just spew out envy and hatred and everything at hell. But he said, actually, I've seen some of them converted. Because they don't like themselves and they know they're a mess. You know? So it's kind of interesting. Yeah.
Lenny, can you talk a bit more about this idea of making ends with means, making ends with means, and where you sort of see that today?
Well, let me see. I know it pops up in a lot of different places, but I mean, I love what he says there, just about this very thing of anybody who is in the one that he gave, of course, is one in the arts, but I think it can happen to anybody, like even a teacher. You know, you can. And I think Lewis really identified it with it himself. He goes on to talk about that he could see himself being pretty proud of his various arguments that he could come up with the existence of God, but that you know, and forget about God himself. But the point is God, not just I have all these cool arguments for the existence of God. That's just a help to hopefully get people to see and know God himself. But we get kind of stuck on the things that are a process rather than toward what end. You know, fall in love with the means to the end rather than that. And I think that what the artist thing is that there's really a fallacy in this idea of art for art's sake, you know, as just self-expression. It's communication and it's for something. It's to show people something about truth and about beauty. For the love of those things which are true and beautiful. You paint to show somebody else something, or you write to show somebody something. Just to make yourself feel good about it, or make whatever the means for. Yeah, sorry, bouncing in my head, but every once in a while I'll see, oh, that's a means. That's not an end. It's a good question to ask about certain things that you get wrapped up in.
Just one example I thought of when we were in grad school and studying theology, there was a whole seminar that some of the professors led on how to study theology without losing your faith. You're so caught up in studying exegesis and stressing out about the academics and engaging with very important ideas, but if it's at the expense of
your prayer life, for instance,
if it's at the expense of relating to God personally,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
then you're replacing the end of the needs.
Yeah. Yeah. Service can become an end in itself when it's supposed to actually be
a
for something. Okay. Signs of service. Yeah.
Yeah, I was struck by this Sarah Smith probably the most too, and just it was interesting because when they're looking at her and they say that she loved all children like sons and daughters, and,
yes, yes.
and all men were her lovers, but in a way that made them more faithful, mm-hmm. or the children loved their parents more. But yet, when she was talking to her husband, or the dwarf, she said that she never really knew how to love on her, like because she needed him, and it was because of her need for him, she never really loved him, I guess, in a selfless way, because she needed to be loved. But when she was in heaven, she was in love for the first time, like she was located in love.
Yeah, that's really powerful.
I found that so interesting, and... yeah, just that she loved, it seemed like she loved Eleanor, but never realized it.
Right. And there was a lack of self-consciousness, definitely.
Yeah.
There,
yes,
but,
yes.
But I guess the message is that there's so much more,
right.
you know, beyond even mm-hmm. beyond the best that we see mm-hmm. here on Earth, because it's tainted mm-hmm. always in some way by thinking about ourselves.
And, or twisted from our twisted. Need for each other.
Yeah, our neediness, kind of need love mm-hmm. and stuff. Yeah, like, there's so much overlap with the four loves mm-hmm. in this book. That's a really fabulous one to read about the various kinds of love, like love turning into hate, actually. And it's need love. Mm-hmm. You really see that. Yeah, that's an interesting observation. Yeah.
One more question. The point you're talking about at the very end, this whole idea of people in hell blackmailing heaven to be miserable. And unless I'm willing to be happy on my own terms. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make sure you're miserable. Everyone else is miserable. Somewhere in, I don't know whether it's in this book or somewhere else in the, he gives the analogy of like the little boy that would, go up to the attic and basically stay there until his sisters would come and coax him out, And it was the same exact sort of.
Well, the Virginian as a little boy was like that. Okay. He was blackmailing everybody from the time he was a little boy. I mean, if you read that whole story, the whole long story of him, it might have been that, but it might be somewhere else too, where he's got that.
But it was the same sort of thing, where it's
really,
no one else can be happy at dinner if I'm upstairs unhappy.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I've got like a stranglehold mm-hmm. on everybody. Mm-hmm. it's such a powerful.
It really is powerful, it really makes you think about. It's just, these people, our choices really, we become something because of what we've chosen. Just the littlest choices make us into people who eventually are barely human anymore. And it's really a sad, sad thing, but it kind of helps you see a little bit more clearly, on what terms could we possibly, not have something that works like this. If we want significance, it's at this cost,
Sorry, one more thing. I was just thinking how profound it was with the woman who, felt the shame of being kind of, underdressed and mm-hmm. Not prepared and how that was just so, to me, that was just so profound how shame can kind of, if, what was it you said? If you follow it to the end, it's sort of because it reveals, you're revealing your, it reveals your depravity and sort of, leads to repentance, I think. If you think about in the Bible, two examples that took shame in a very different way, Judas Iscariot versus mm-hmm. Peter, and how they both betrayed Jesus, but mm-hmm. then, Peter became, the most, like sold out advocate for Jesus, right. And then like, you know, whatever,
right.
Judas,
right.
And and how just like shame, I think like it can be like really tricky because like it can just like lead to feeling like really like that despair, but it can also lead to being like realizing how much you need Jesus and how you just need to like how completely, yeah, like. It kind of leaves you in awe in a way.
That we deserve nothing from and that we get so much.
Yeah.
And
right.
It's so hard for us to admit that
right.
Now. And that's the beauty of it is, like you say, that we're so needy. And to be honest about that neediness, we get so much from love and mercy and grace of God out of that. But not because we've somehow caught his attention, you know, by having some good traits here and there. Pretty powerful. Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thank you.